Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Good evening, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm here tonight with Scott Lemieux and Robert Farley, and this is our post-election pre-coup rundown here, figuring as November 19th as this is being recorded, and American democracy is not doing very well right now. So we're going to start tonight by talking a little bit about what on earth is going on with Trump and Giuliani and this clown show that is the Republican Party. Rob, do you want to start this time and talk about your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess first things first, if this is the if the coup succeeds and this is the last Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast, all I hope is that we are all sent to the same labor camp. Scott, since you're not a citizen, you'll probably be sent to a different labor camp, right? Or possibly even expatriated, right? I mean, that would probably be the best
scenario. Yeah, fortunately, I'm only 3 hours from the border, so which admittedly is closed to Americans, but hopefully I can find right. Somebody to smuggle me in a boat over the Okanagan River or something.
Right. You know, I mean, what's really fascinated me about this is that political scientists have lots of different ways of describing what a coup is. And some of these academic disagreements have been playing out over Twitter. It's like, is this a coup? If it's a coup, what kind of coup it is? As we drift towards, President Trump applying direct pressure to Michigan election officials, President Trump applying direct pressure to the Michigan legislature to do something that is wildly unconstitutional, it has just been increasingly obvious that, wow, I mean, we are sort of in the midst of perhaps the worst coup ever, right? It may be sort of the least competent coup that I am familiar with, but this is effectively an administrative coup, right? He's placing pressure on government officials to effectively deny the winner of the election, right? It's just sort of fascinating to me, sort of going back to November 5th, when this whole industry of folks just sort of developed on Twitter and elsewhere to explain carefully to histrionic liberals, oh, he's going to lose and then he's just going to disappear. And I think Glenn Greenwald was, the worst thing for liberals would be if Donald Trump just accepted defeat and disappeared. And Shadi Hamid was, liberals are always fanatical about this sort of authoritarianism, but I'm sure it'll amount to nothing. And then effectively Trump living up to the worst fantasies of the resistance, right? In terms of, pursuing these, blatantly extra-legal attempts to overturn the democratic election. And then the comparisons being made, complaining about Russia is, making him illegitimate. Clinton, of course, conceded the next day, right? And the transition started by this time, right? And so it's absurd, but there's still this on both sort of among your sort of classic centrists and in your anti-Trump, which I think we can now just say your pro-Trump left, to just sort of wish away this aggressive effort to effectively destroy the American electoral system. It's fascinating to me, right? If I wasn't living it, I would find it analytically just terribly interesting.
Yeah, I think Corey Robbins still believes he's been completely vindicated in denying that Trump had any authoritarian, and again, this weird idea that like authoritarianism isn't authoritarianism unless you succeed, it's like literally like unless you actually, install Nazism, then, it's just so stupid. And honestly, this, the thing with the Michigan law, that is, really serious. The fact that, they didn't reject the invitation out of hand, is a really serious problem. And just that, everything about, this is classic Jim Crow stuff. We'll certify the votes from Livonia, but not from Detroit. I mean, it doesn't get much more, explicit than that. I mean, there's really no pretense anymore. That's just literally like, that there's no concrete claims of fraud. It's just that black votes shouldn't count. That's literally the only argument being made here. And the fact that Michigan legislators, and again, this all, as I wrote earlier today, it all comes back to the fact that legislatures in three critical swing states are gerrymandered beyond Democratic control and with the approval of the Republican Supreme Court. And I think I more firmly believe than ever that Rucho is an even worse decision than Shelby County. Because frankly, Shelby County is irrelevant, pre-clearance is irrelevant with Bill Barr as the Attorney General anyway. But the fact that, if it was possible for legislators in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania to lose elections, we wouldn't be seeing this. You know, like that's a major part of what's facilitating this. So it's a serious. I mean, that's the Trump going through with this and the legislative leadership in Michigan being willing to meet with them. That's pretty scary. You know, I still think it's highly unlikely to work. And it seems like Pennsylvania Republicans are not really on board with it yet. But you know, it's still. And again, let's be clear. You know, the only thing we know now is that if the election was any closer, it would be stolen. You know, if Biden does not pull out Arizona and Georgia, we are in deep, deep trouble here. So that even if it doesn't work this time, what it says for next time, it's not a sustainable situation where Democrats have to win by 6 million votes to have any chance of carrying the White House. That's not a sustainable system.
For me anyway, between the election and COVID, it's been grimly satisfying is not the right word, but I guess there's a little bit of that to me to watch the belief of a lot of people, particularly liberals, in that the country is really like has good values and this is an anomaly and et cetera. Falls in it just totally collapse in the face of just how broken this country is. And I really think that, it's distressing, but it's perhaps it serves a purpose in that I think that people are finally kind of waking up to what the Republican Party actually is, that Trump is not an anomaly, as well as to some of the really significant problems within American culture. But I also think that the really key comparison here, because we see so much on Twitter and things, oh, were these Nazis? And then there's just like too much History Channel watching. It's Jim Crow, right? This is the actual goal. Like, it's to reimpose Jim Crow, except that, and yes, Jim Crow was a national phenomenon, but it was mostly Southern. In this case, it is literally Jim Crow at the national level. That is almost the stated goal here. And white racism is so deep that it's entirely at least possible that it succeeds, and if not this time in 2024, and this is why I think that we have to have these real conversations about race in this country, including among liberals, because the goal here ultimately is to separate out the races and create an anti-black majority, and we see some of the effectiveness of this in South Florida and in South Texas among Latino populations that are happy to join along with this, as well as the failure of the affirmative action ballot measure in California because of large scale voting against it by both Asian and Latino populations. So I think that there's we're really on the precipice here, both in terms of this election and what happens between now and January 20th, but also going forward over the next 4 years. And it's a very, very scary time. And ever since about 2014, really since the 2014 midterms, my feeling has sort of been that the U.S. has a horrible disease, and maybe not, we outlived this disease. And 6 years later, we definitely have not outlived that disease.
Yeah, and that's where the results in the Rio Grande Valley in South Florida are so disturbing, because there's really not a lot that can be done about the Republican advantage of the Senate, but the Electoral College is not nearly as, it's just about who wins the closest swing states. And so the best way of alleviating Republican authoritarianism would be to flip Florida and Texas. But unfortunately, we were unable to do that again in a way. Not that winning Texas this year was especially realistic, and we did at least improve there. But to actually do worse than Clinton in Florida, while increasing the national margin by 3 or 4 points, that's a real problem. Same thing, and again, the loss of Bill Nelson's seat looms really large. But that's 100% correct that the fact that it's not just white Americans who are willing to vote for an anti-black political party is a real serious problem going forward. And like you, I have no immediate solution to that, but it's something that we need to have a lot of frank conversations about.
Go ahead,
Aaron. No, go ahead, Rob, please.
I mean, the other thing we have to remember here is that it is not simply anti-black; it's also sort of emotively anti-feminist, right? And I think that's sort of where a lot of the analyses missed out, right? Yeah, where I mean, Trump did not make substantial gains among African-American women or Latino women, right? He made substantial gains among men, African-American men and Latino men, right? He is performative anti-feminism personified, right? And so I think that's a lot of what's going on here, and possibly also explains the difference between Clinton and Biden this time around. I mean, there's a lot of other factors, but it's definitely a concern.
I still go back to, I think one of the best things written about the 2016 election was Rebecca Traister's piece about how, you know, an incompetent man beating a competent woman isn't anomalous. It's every Tuesday in America, you know, and then there's still, I don't think we fully reckon with the fact that, you know, a major party presidential candidate could admit to serially sexually assaulting women on tape and go ahead to run a competitive enough race to win. How many women have credibly accused Donald Trump of sexually assault that it's not even a major news story? It's not the only reason Biden did a lot better than Clinton, but it's certainly, you know, because we know it's not ideology, you know, that we've controlled for. I think Biden did run a somewhat better campaign, but I don't think that explains, you know, the difference. I don't think we've reckoned enough with that. I absolutely think that it's a major part of this question.
Yeah, and you know, I often tell my students this, that, you know, we've become at least left of center comfortable talking about race, at least at a certain level. And so you can have a book like Ibram Kendi's, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and you know, it may make some people feel uncomfortable. I know that a lot of people dislike my posts on schooling that are intended to throw people off balance. But ultimately, we do have conversations about race. We're actually farther behind in having conversations about misogyny. You know, that misogyny, I think, is, if anything, more deeply entrenched to the point that we're not even truly recognizing it yet as the tremendous power that it is. And it's also notable here, right, that Trump's performative anti-feminism was, if anything, among outside of college-educated whites, was, if anything, more powerfully displayed and more politically successful against Joe Biden than it was against Hillary Clinton, right? Because he was able to expand that into non-white communities after 4 years of acting this way. I think that the biggest wake-up call that liberals have had to figure out, and as well as the sort of Republican elites and never-Trumper types, you know, all six of them, is that Donald Trump is successful because of his behavior. This is what people want. They want this. And that's the real wake-up call about America, is that, and this is why all this discussion that, you know, that, oh, you know, as soon as Trump loses, you know, the Republican Party is going to forget that, you know, they're going to forget that he was in power, and they're going to distance themselves from them. No, they're not. Like, it's just going to become more Trumpist because this is what people want. And I think that the elite class of the Republican Party is, really doesn't like this. I mean, obviously for a Mitt Romney, this is horrifying, or Paul Ryan. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, there's a reason that clowns like Herman Cain and Ben Carson and Sarah Palin had real presidential boomlets, and they, because these voters were looking for somebody to do this, and they found it, you know, in their ultimate version of it in Donald Trump. And, and I think that it's very alarming to many of people, that Trump had so many more voters than he did in 2016, even if Democrats had more than that, nonetheless, like Trump drives voters, and he will continue to, whether, you know, regardless of what happens over the next 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, I'm glad Mike Cooley reminded us of the direct path from Palin to Trump. And honestly, hearing Sarah's flame, it makes me think, you know, like a less lazy Sarah Palin 100% could have won the Republican primary in 2012. Like, basically, Romney ran effectively unopposed, and it was like painfully difficult. You know, like Rick Santorum, who couldn't even get off the kiddie table, like legitimately pushed him a long time. And the other thing people keep forgetting about 2012, Mitt Romney won that by running to the far right on immigration. You know, by literally running to the right of, you know, that has just dropped completely. You know, now that Romney's back is like the decent established Republican, people have really forgotten how the dynamics in that primary, that, you know, Romney won that because he saw where the party was going. You know, that wasn't a coincidence. And you can see that the way Lindsey Graham's acting, you know, he just won re-election. He's not trying to like kiss Trump's ass. He's not scared. He believes in authoritarianism. You know, that's it. The Republicans psyching up to Trump now are doing it because they want to, not because they have to. And the stuff about Georgia, that's a pretext. Like, it's really not obvious that Trump trying to steal this helps the Georgia runoff. It's an excuse. Like, they're trying to delegitimize the election. And if it ends up working, great. But that's what's going on here. It's not about people are too scared to stand up for Trump, or they're scared that Georgia voters won't stay with them. Yeah, again, if you think it's about Trump, you know, two sons of a former president stole an election in 2000. this isn't a new, you know, the Republican contempt for democracy goes, you know, John Roberts has been trying to undo the Voting Rights Act since he was a functionary in the Reagan administration. You know, this is not new. Trump is a symptom.
Scott, it's a republic, not a
Sorry. Yes, that's right. Yes, that's the important thing. Exactly.
Before we move on and talk about talk about what happened on November 3rd itself, and some of those issues, I want to ask a kind of a tough question, which is, what do you think happens on January 20th?
I'll let Rob take that one.
If anybody who listened to our previous podcast will recognize that I'm incurably optimistic, right? So I do not think that Trump will concede in the sense that he will admit that he was beaten, right? I think he will concede in the sense that he will describe the forces that essentially stole the election from him as being too powerful this time around, and will acknowledge that he has to leave before the 20th. And then whether he shows up to the inauguration, whether he goes through any of the other motions with respect, I suspect probably not, but, you know, I still can be surprised. But I think that even if we don't have a concession, we'll have an acknowledgement of defeat that will then enable a transition in January in which Trump will leave the White House and Biden will occupy it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, assuming that that a majority of the electors end up being appointed and certified for Biden, which I still expect to happen, that's what I expect. Trump just basically says, I have to leave because the election was stolen from me. I was betrayed, blah, 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 blah. And I'm also pretty confident he doesn't show up to the inaugural or do any of the other things that that would generally mark a transition. And in itself, that's in itself problematic. It's remarkable that the modern Republican, as Jamel Bowie pointed out recently, the contemporary Republican Party is like worse than the Federalists of 1800, who had a substantial like actual monarchist component to them. And like, even when the Federalists were trying to steal the election, it was like, let's make Aaron Burr president. It was never like make Adams president. You know, they weren't trying to claim the Jeffersonians shouldn't be in power in some way. It's pretty scary to think that like what they're attempting to do now is what was worse than the coup that the Federalists tried to pull off before American democracy was even established. And it's pretty frightening. Again, I expect him to leave office, but to leave office as part of this plan to sort of delegitimize and really, you know, set it up to make it enormously difficult for a Democratic incumbent to be reelected in 2024. Okay.
I'm being probably a little inherently less optimistic. I do think Joe Biden will be president on January 20th. It would not surprise me if federal marshals had to escort Donald Trump out of the Oval Office. I think that it's pretty sad that the one thing you're holding on to is that everybody in the elite kind of bureaucracy hates Donald Trump, including the military, and many of the judges. And so I don't think it'll work, but I think it'll go up to the very, very end. And then I think Donald Trump will announce he's running for president in 2024 on day one, and he'll continue to hold rallies. And that Donald Trump will not be going away anytime soon. And whoever the 24 nominee is, whether it is, it's either going to be Donald Trump himself, or it's going to be whoever Donald Trump wants it to be, whether that's Trump Jr. or Tucker or some other figure. So.
And not Tom Cotton. I'm going to lay down that marker right now, despite what like the media's going to spend 3 years telling you. But yeah.
So on less apocalyptic matters, one question that I think a lot of people you know, everybody sort of, well, I guess everybody sort of took a deep breath when Biden was finally announced that he had won. And a lot of people are just happy to have Joe Biden as president and that it is going to be a Democrat, at least theoretically. And the question is, I think that is worth asking, because there was all this electability conversation around Biden, and that's really, you know, between that and between, you know, the reason I think, the two reasons I think that Biden was able to win the nomination is, one, Obama nostalgia, and two, a two, fear of Trump. And that was through a very large part of the Democratic electorate. And so one question I think we can ask is, what would have happened if it had not been Donald Trump, right? What if it had been Bernie? What if it had been another, you know, if Biden hadn't sucked all the air out of the room, and it might have been a Harris, it might have been a Cory Booker, you know, did it have to be Joe Biden, who I think we can probably mostly agree is not a transformative figure at all. He does himself has said that. Do we think we could have done better than Joe Biden?
I mean, he will be the oldest president, and he will be also the most experienced in government president, and that's not a transformative figure.
I mean, so there's two questions here. So there's the, you know, could we have done better substantively, and could we have done better electorally? You know, and substantively, I mean, one thing is that the results of the Senate election mean that it's just not as, you know, again, the outcome of the Florida runoffs is going to have a much bigger impact on public policy than the winner, than who won the Democratic primary. You know, that just, you know, not only, you know, legislatively, it just really does not matter very much exactly how far to the left of the median Senate vote the president is. And that's true whether it's Manchin as the median vote or whether Republicans just keep control of the Senate. And even in terms of executive branch appointments and stuff, like, it, you know, certainly Bernie or Warren's would probably be better on balance. But the fact is, you know, you're drawing from a fairly limited pool of people, and, you know, you still need buy-in to be able to do stuff. You know, you can't. So, you know, fundamentally, I guess one thing about the, you know, the depressing Senate outcome is that it means that I'm less depressed about the outcome of the Democratic primary, because, you know, and if anything, you know, having somebody who's clearly on the left of the party come in and not, you know, really be able to accomplish much of an agenda would, if anything, set them, you know. So it does, you know, at this point, I'm, you know, I'm happy to have Warren and Bernie in the Senate. It doesn't really, you know, it's not that important. You know, I'd rather have had a younger, you know, I still, my favorite counterfactual is, what if neither Bernie nor Biden runs? You know, and then you kind of get, you know, at any rate, they, you know, the fact is, you know, Bernie was the strongest candidate, so nobody else really had a shot. And then he, you know, completely botched the campaign. And, you know, having said that, I'm not sure that he could have won. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, Iglesias keeps making this point, but, you know, Biden's strategy of focusing on the most popular issues and running on them was actually, you know, there's actually a lot to be said for that. You know, so, you know, he was shrewder than we all give his credit for. Electorally, you know, I generally don't like these counterfactuals, because who knows? I mean, I think the most natural assumption has to be that anybody who could win the primary, you know, could have won. But, you know, that there is a point, you know, if you're sympathetic towards Biden, more than I am, you can say that, you know, the fact is he did assemble a broad coalition. He won. His campaign didn't make a lot of obvious mistakes. You know, unlike Clinton, he stuck mostly to campaigning in tipping point states, and his attempt to extend the map to Georgia, which was extremely shrewd and extremely important. And indeed, I think what Biden understood that a lot of his critics didn't was that, you know, it wasn't enough for the election to come down to Pennsylvania. You know, you really needed a cushion to thwart Republican electoral theft attempts and to help with Senate races. So, you know, I mean, you know, and then there's always things, you know, a Bernie who won the nomination would have been a different candidate who ran a different campaign with different staff. So it's sort of, you know, it's that's always the problem with these counterfactuals, that, you know, I think that, you know, other Democratic candidates may have been able to win, but you also have to say at a certain point that, if, you know, if Cory Booker could have won the presidency, why did he get no traction at all? But, you know, like, at some point, you know, Biden won the primary, he won the election, he ran a good campaign. So, you know, I think it's, you know, I doubt that anybody could have done much better. I mean, he's going to win by, you know, by a huge popular vote margin, beating an incumbent president. And, you know, other people could have won, but, you know, they didn't win the primary, and we don't know that. So I guess, you know, ultimately, I think you have to give Biden some credit there. I don't know, Eric, if you see a different path there, but.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm of two minds about this. I mean, the strongest part of me is inclined to say that Biden was as close to as perfect of a candidate for the particular mood this year as you could imagine, right? So sort of this restoration, which we all know is bullshit, but people were feeling that, right? So that's on the one hand, the sort of panic of COVID, and Biden has this kind of empathy to him that feeds very well into that. His campaign seemed to be strong. You know, and I know that sort of neighboring state effects are controversial in political science, but to be perfectly honest, it's hard for me to see any of the other candidates doing quite as well in Pennsylvania as Biden did, right? Because, you know, he's born in Scranton and he lives right across the border, right? And, you know, I think as Paul Campos keeps pointing out, right, we can talk about how this was a blow all the time, but we know better, right? We know that actually the number of votes that separated them in the Electoral College was pretty fucking slim, right? And so, yeah, but all, so I am inclined to think that Biden did as well as a Democratic candidate could have done. On the other hand, I mean, I think that what the major Republican turnout really demonstrated is that even against Joe Biden, they were able to mobilize all of these words that they were going to throw at Bernie and they were going to throw at everybody else, right? And they got how many votes? 72 million votes right now? More than that, right? You know, what could they have said against Bernie that would have produced that many more votes, that would have alarmed more people, right? So they were able to mobilize. And this, you know, sort of goes back to the conversation that Spangborn and AOC and so forth are having, right? You know, they were able to throw all of that stuff at Biden and it stuck, the same stuff they were going to throw at Bernie. Now, you know, in the end, I don't know if Bernie would have won. I don't think Elizabeth Warren would have won. And I don't know about the rest of the candidates, but that's sort of a gut feeling, and I go back and forth on it.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing is that the thing about Bernie is that if, let's say that if this election were close or lost because Biden couldn't carry Nevada and Arizona, I think then you'd have a case because, you know, the one thing Bernie clearly did better was outreach to younger Hispanic voters. But given the actual map, I don't, what state is Bernie winning that Biden didn't? You know, sure as hell not Florida.
Right.
I think we know that. And I think I it's very hard for me to see Bernie winning Georgia either, quite frankly.
Well, and so. 7 points is a big space to cover in Ohio too, right? And, you know, I don't remember what North Carolina turned out, right? But I think Biden crushed Bernie in North Carolina? I don't recollect.
Oh,
but
the entire South, basically.
Right. So there's no reason to think Bernie would have been stronger in those places.
Yeah. And obviously, as you know, Florida in particular, like, you know, South Florida is about the worst conceivable, like, Bernie, you know, if you think, like, you know, like, you know, I mean, he might have, like, lost Miami-Dade outright. So, you know, I think that given the way the map, you know, and again, there are other contingencies, a non-COVID election, things could work out differently. But, you know, and again, with Warren, I mean, you know, I think Kate Manning's made this point for a long time, you know, whatever the misogyny tax is on candidates is probably enough to throw the Electoral College to Trump even before you get to, you know, and the fact that, you know, the media liked Biden and probably would have given tougher coverage to Warren or to a lesser extent Bernie. You know, given how close things were in the Electoral College, you know, it's, yeah, I, you know, it's, again, I don't really regret having supported Warren, but I have to say how things came out. Am I confident that she would have won? Absolutely not.
Yeah, I tend to agree on this. For a long time, you know, my take on the election was it really doesn't matter who gets nominated by Democrats. The only question is, do you want 4 more years of this or not? But I think that we were all hoping that there wouldn't be such a huge number of people who said, oh, hell yes, I want 4 more years of this. Please, 8, 12.
I will rush out and vote during a pending hour.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's a little disturbing. And it is funny how I'm seeing, especially on sort of liberal Twitter, or some extent our comments too, people saying, oh, actually, it was a big win for Biden. Like, it wasn't a close win. And that's just... post, you know, that's just justification. I mean, that's not true at all. It was incredibly close. And yes, the Electoral College is, you know, I mean, whatever it is, over 300 votes. Yeah, he could have lost another state or two and theoretically have won without the cheating by Republicans. But it was very, very easy for this to go another way. And that's very sobering. And I do, one thing I have noticed is, minus the usual suspects, there's been very, very little, I think, on left Twitter about saying, oh, Bernie would have won. I'm not really seeing that much of that, actually. You know, there's the kind of preemptive disappointment with Biden that one can, basically predict from the left. But there's much less than 2016 is there this narrative that, oh, somebody else could have won. And I think that's because it was so close. And so it's hard to argue that a Warren or a Bernie would have done as well as Biden. I think given that so many, given that so many people are so heavily committed to Trump, and given that so many voters are so uneducated and not right. I mean, I think it's also that as we exist in our own communities, and everybody who's on political Twitter or political blogs or reads the New York Times or whatever is in their own little bubbles, and they think that people are like them. But no, like, people are not like you. Right. The fact that we're sitting here having this conversation automatically makes us super nerds. And, a lot of people out there are barely paying attention at all. And so this is part of the appeal for a guy like Trump. He's entertaining and he's, he makes them feel good about themselves and all of this stuff. And, they're not going to really be paying attention to, healthcare plans. As much as we would like that to be, they're not paying that much attention to who has a better healthcare plan because they're not really thinking about it. And it's a sobering fact, but it's true. So, and this gets to, I think, another critical question. If you had told me that Biden wins Arizona and he wins Georgia, he comes within a hair of winning North Carolina, and then if you had told me, if we're really lucky, we might get 50 votes in the Senate and we're going to lose a good 10 seats in the House, I would have said there's no way that this is the final, that this is what happens. Like, that's not a realistic possibility. And yet that's exactly what happened. So what happened in the House and Senate?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this may be the part where, we have to talk about what went wrong with the polls, right? The polling, to be fair, like, there were some indications in the polling that things were going a little bit south in the Senate in the last couple of weeks, right? Because Ernst was demonstrating a clear lead and Gideon, the Collins Gideon was narrowing for some reason. I don't know what the hell's wrong with people up there, but there were others where it wasn't, like, North Carolina, right? He was ahead in every poll, right? How did that happen? And we got none of the reaches, right? Normally you would get like one of the reaches and we got none.
Yeah, Greenfield. Yeah, I mean, Ernst was approving, but that was still not even close, that was right. A lot closer than the polls and looked at.
I mean, the really insane thing, and I want to make a because it's referring to something you talked about earlier, Eric, about how just stunned we are that this many people showed up to vote for Trump. In 2019 we had an election in Kentucky, and maybe in some ways this could be considered a bit of a harbinger, because Matt Bevin was he won the Republican primary against Mitch McConnell's picked candidate. So, like, Mitch does not run Kentucky. People need to understand that, right? He won the Republican primary by 36 votes, then won the election by like 10,000 against a Democratic candidate. Widely hated by everyone, right? I mean, loathed by Republicans in the state, hated by teachers, right? Just wild enthusiasm, hateful enthusiasm towards this, human tapeworm, right? I mean, he's just a god-awful human being. And he loses by 5,000 votes to the son of the previous governor, getting 100,000 more votes than he did his first time around, right? And so it's like exactly what happens at a national scale. And the same thing happens, the Republicans now have a supermajority in the Kentucky Senate. So huge gains down ticket, right? All of this stuff happening. And, at some point we have to sort of revisit our question about that voter turnout is always going to be a benefit for our side, right? I mean, we were all talking about how voter turnout was amazing. And just like at some point, the turnout, maybe it's a curve that works in an odd way in which, you get to 50%, that's good for the Dems. You get to 65%, it starts getting good for the Republicans again. I mean, that sort of thing does happen. And maybe that's what's happening, right? But no, I'm stunned. I'm the same way, the same thing you said, Eric, right? I'm stunned at how poorly we did, how far behind Biden the congressional candidates ran.
Yeah, and what's depressing is, that's just the fun of it, is that right now the structural advantages for the Republican Party in both houses are so strong that if both parties turn out, it's just almost impossible to win, and that's the depressing thing about the Senate is that, you know, like Gideon seems to have been a pretty weak candidate. I mean, that's the one that really should have, you know, that should have been won. You know, Cunningham, you know, and it's hard to say how much that stupid PG-13 affair, but it still wasn't, you know, didn't help. But, you know, Bullock ran ahead of Biden. He's a good candidate. He's won statewide races there. Greenfield seemed to run a good campaign, ran ahead of Biden. You know, it's not like Democrats weren't able to recruit strong candidates. You know, I think Warnock and Ossoff, you know, they could still win. You know, so it's not even that like we weren't able to recruit competitive candidates in these races. It's just, you know, if there's full turnout from both sides and elections are national, and that's really what ultimately happened in the House. You know, there certainly may be individual races where the campaigns were good enough, you know, but I ultimately think that this moderate versus, I mean, the fact is that, you know, what happened was that in 2018, Democrats had a +8 advantage, and this year we have a +6 advantage. And so all those marginal seats that you don't have 2 points to spare in, we lost. You know, it's a little more complicated than that, but it's not that much more complicated. You know, and that's that fundamentally, if Republicans fully turn out, it's just really hard to beat them given this institutional terrain. That's, you know, and again, I'm not saying, you know, there always need to be things that we could do better in recriminations, but it's a hell of a lot easier to win elections when you're starting with a 7-point handicap. I mean, that's the fundamental, you know, and it's not, you know, there's no magic bullet that can overcome that. And like, sorry, you can't, you know, yes, you know, defund the police is not a popular thing, but like, it's not within the power of Democratic Party to stop activists from ever saying anything unpopular. You know, it's not like Democratic politicians were running on that. So, I mean, that's just, you know, and I mean, again, you compare that to the kind of crazy shit that Republican activists say. I mean,
I mean, this is what sort of really fascinated me living in Kentucky, right? So you guys both live in sort of safely blue places, right? But I got lots of advertising in the Kentucky Senate race because both sides had tons of money. And I got lots of advertising in KY6, which is a Republican district that covers Lexington. I don't remember any McConnell or Andy Barr ad mentioning Joe Biden, right? Like Harris, yes. AOC, yes. Omar, yes. Bernie, like, I mean, the whole, that just ran through these hateful figures for the right and associated them either with, you know, I mean, McGrath was a socialist who was best friends with AOC and who, you know, shockingly to the rest of the world, right? Same thing with Josh Hicks, but that was every ad, right? It was just saying that, you know, Amy McGrath was a fighter pilot, a Marine, a mom, and a communist who wants to take away your healthcare, right? And same thing with Josh Hicks, who was the House candidate here. And there's something odd, right, is that we can't seem to do that in putting Louis Gohmert in every single ad and that's who you're running against. Like, for some reason, that doesn't work on our side. I mean, I don't understand, because Gohmert is like an inherently loathsome figure. And yet, either from a lack of imagination or just because there's something structurally different about the rhetoric, that just doesn't work on our side.
Yeah.
It's a great point.
You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do over the years at the blog and in my writing and things and in my teaching really too, is to push people off of their pat narratives and make them a little uncomfortable. And sometimes that gets me into trouble. And this is why, you know, I get into tiffs both sometimes on the blog and also with, you know, the Jacobin people and stuff. But one of them that is deeply problematic is this idea that it's been very powerful that if we just get out the vote, there's all of these undecided voters and people who don't turn out, they're going to come out and they're going to be on our side. Well, bullshit they are, right? It's this world of imagining voters that don't exist. And the Bernie campaign was totally guilty of this, right? That they had this vision that they would be able to pull all these people in. I was like, no, like your campaign, your base is college educated white people. It's the same base as Elizabeth Warren's, except younger, right? And so this is, there's so much, people are so high on their own supply when it comes to narratives among liberals and the left, and certainly in, you know, we're not talking about this today, but certainly within the labor movement, people are, you know, and the kind of belief in organizing and things like this, that it's going to, you know, that my kind of common joke is that, you know, if only these politicians or unions or the people do whatever it is that I think is right, then everything will be okay and people will act exactly as I think that they will. And obviously that's just not true, right? we can expand the vote, but that's expanding the vote to a whole lot of people who are not paying a lot of attention, who have a lot of racism and misogyny in them, and who can well be attracted to other people. Now, it doesn't mean the answer is not that we stop organizing. I think the actual answer, in part, is that people actually need more politics in their lives, not necessarily electoral politics, which I think, especially here at LGN, could really get overplayed in terms of the importance of that within the broader world of politics. But the day-to-day politics of organizing is ultimately, in part, going to have to be the answer here, to figure out ways to engage people outside of just an election cycle. And I think that it's hard to do that these days because of the lack of institutions that are able to do this. I mean, you know, the right has mega churches, right? The right has Fox News. These are powerful institutions. Unions are decimated. And where, you know, unions exist, you know, they do a pretty good job of this stuff, but they're decimated. And I think we see this in the the massive individualized campaign donation model of small donors that is just, you know, it's over, you know, like in Maine, you know, just overwhelming overwhelming the state with money that ends up not actually mattering because people just start tuning out or they get resentful or just they stop caring. Like, more money doesn't actually help. So I think that we have to find ways to shift some of this into different sorts of politics, to engage them between election cycles around issues, and then move them forward through institutions that we build in order to politicize them in these other ways. That said, who's going to do that? Where's the money? Where's the resources? Where's the infrastructure? You know, it's easy to say. It's a hell of a hard thing to do. But I think that's a big part of the problem here. They have these big institutions and we don't.
Right. So actually, Eric, one of the things you just said there lends a lot of insight into the question I just asked, right? Which is, you know, why is it that AOC is poison, but Louie Gohmert isn't, right? And that answer is just straightforwardly Fox News, right? It's because Fox News is, you know, and we can grant that there are certain of the criticisms of the mainstream media that come from conservatives that are sort of true, right? But none, MSNBC does not spend its time vilifying Louie Gohmert and making sure that every person in New York knows that Louie Gohmert is going to, you know, make them have guns or something, whatever he would do, right? Whereas Fox News has that sort of message discipline, that they can put AOC and they can connect every story to Ilhan Omar or AOC or whomever and create those as real household names in their viewers in a way that sort of, you know, liberals who are more reliant on sort of the conventional mainstream media just don't get. We just don't get a diet of that in the same way. I mean, Trump is that person, right? But other than Trump, there are no figures who are like that for liberals.
And incidentally, in terms of the delusions of turnout, I also note, you know, in a story that I'm sure did not get covered by Jacobin, West Virginia Democrats finally ran that progressive candidate who's going to bring out the latent left-wing vote in West Virginia and carried 27% of the votes. I think we're going to be hearing, you know, the whole idea that West Virginia was where you're going to turn things, just, you know, that's a politics that's, however much they talk about class, it's aesthetics, not, you know, but anyway. But yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, and unfortunately, I guess Theda Scotch pulls her own kind of data on this. But, you know, that's the point she was making a while, is that, you know, the internet can replace some forms of traditional civic organization. But, you know, like it's good at raising money. But, you know, that there is, you know, it's not a coincidence that the civil rights movement mostly came out of churches. You know, that's where, you know, people know each other, you know, people get together, you know, that they can engage activism. So, you know, between, you know, the sort of relative decline of organized religion on the left and the decline of organized labor. And again, the Supreme Court is probably going to rule that, you know, allowing organizers, you know, access to agricultural workers is a taking. You know, like this is just this, you know, and, you know, and part of this is the courts. But I also think the Democratic politicians deserve some blame in that, you know, that Republicans do things that are in their interest to help them advance. You know, Democrats, even, you know, and not just liberal Democrats, but, you know, marginal Democrats, if anything, need organized labor more than anybody, but they're not willing to vote for card check. You know, so that, you know, Republicans are do what they need to do to advance their own material self-interest. You know, even a 53 member Democratic Senate, they might not have added Senate seats, even though it's the right thing to do and it would help them. You know, Democrats won't do things that are consistent with their principles and help them. You know, and I think that's a problem, you know, so that, you know, Democrats need to be more focused on strengthening organized labor. I also think Iglesias made a good point recently that, you know, frankly, our blue states need to have better government. You know, I'm actually in an exception where finally Washington State has relatively competent government. But, you know, the caliber of, like Gavin Newsom, you know, very mediocre governor, Cuomo's worse, you know, Rhode Island speaks for itself. You know, I mean, that there are really a lot of Democratic controlled states that, you know, they're frankly, you know, aren't great at enacting ambitious agendas that, you know, don't have especially competent government. And I think that's a real problem, too, that, you know, that we're, you know, certainly Democrats are not maximizing their advantages. But, you know, we're also, you know, that in things like organized labor, you're always fighting uphill. So just marginal things, you know. So it's partly, you know, Democrats not acting against that, but it's also really, you know, it's just, you know, these are difficult things to overcome. And like Eric, I don't have a silver bullet, but I do think the Democrats have to be more focused on doing what they can to help their natural constituencies and help there. And, you know, that's, I think, something Obama can be justly criticized for, is that was, you know, party building, or, you know, it was not something he took seriously. Like, you know, as dumb as this kind of, you know, top down, bottom up theory that was developed to support Bernie, you know, it was a completely valid thing that Bernie understands the importance of this stuff. And frankly, I think that Biden, that is probably an advantage. Biden, who has more connections to labor than Obama has, I suspect he actually understands that more than Obama does, in terms of the, you know, the importance of having these organizations behind you.
Before we leave, just building on something that Scott said, I want to make one final point, which is to talk about the terrible state governments of democratically controlled states. And one of the, on a personal level, you know, probably the biggest victory for Democrats in the state of Rhode Island in a very, very long time came from the Democratic Speaker of the House losing to his Republican challenger this in November. And this is a symbol of just how broken so many of these states are. You know, that Nicholas Mattiello, who was the Speaker of the House, a right-wing Democrat, anti-abortion, gets an A from the NRA. And he was a very powerful speaker. And it was, you know, it being Rhode Island, you see these people all over the place. And a couple of years ago, the Organization of American Historians was in Providence. And I go out to this bar with some friends of mine, and we run into this political fundraiser that Mattiello was at for some other congressman and or state rep. And like, my friend is like, oh my God, these people look like the cast of Goodfellas. And they do. And I'm like, no, there's way less crime in Goodfellas than what you're seeing. like it's, the level of corruption is out of control.
They cook too, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I think the last two or three speakers of the House have served prison time, and Mattiello has recently been on the stand for some, you know, something one of his friends did, and he lost to a Republican. And Democrats had chosen a Speaker of the House in Rhode Island who had to be on the right in order just to win re-election. Right? It's like choosing Joe Manchin to be Senate Majority Leader and letting him set the agenda. And you know, this was crazy. And all of a sudden, the likely new Speaker of the House already, it's like a new day, even though the financial situation because of COVID is disastrous. It's like, oh, now we're moving forward on marijuana legalization all of a sudden. Now all of these things are going to be moving forward simply because Democrats don't have this horrible roadblock. And it's a big problem at the state level, too, which is why we need a lot more state level engagement. And also Gavin Newsom can choke the next time he goes to French Laundry. Yeah, you're really helping there, Gavin. Anyway, well, we should get going here. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you next time.
Thank you.
See you, gentlemen.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,